Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Associated Press is reporting the sound of gunfire in Tehran, where despite a ban on demonstrations and a report that Iran's supreme leader ordered an investigation into last week's election, thousands of Iranians have been rallying today, protesting the re-election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Mousavi, their candidate, the former Iranian Prime Minister Mir Hossein Mousavi, who showed up at the rally today and told his followers to remain calm and continue their peaceful protest. There are no reports as to whether Mousavi is still at the rally, and we don't yet know how serious the reported shooting is. The AP says one person may have been killed. But just before these news reports, we asked Sadek Sabah, an analyst for the BBC's Persian television service in London, what he was seeing. Cell phone service and many social network sites are shut down, but we can see some pictures on Twitter and some video on YouTube. So we asked Sadek what kind of reports he was getting, what he was seeing and hearing from cities in Iran.
As far as we know, in Tehran, tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets, and also we have reports from other Iranian cities like Shiraz, Isfahan, Ahvaz, Rasht, where also people have taken to the streets to demonstrate.
Another comment we understand that is being heard and read during these protests is Tiananmen plus Twitter equals Tehran. I'm on Twitter right now. I'm looking at images from today's protest with comments from people around the world. But we know how Tiananmen Square ended. What's the sense of how this will end today in Iran?
These are not necessarily people who are against the Islamic Republic as such. They are the ordinary people of Iran who decided to change the direction of their country through the ballot box, through the peaceful means. And now they feel that their hopes are shattered, but what they see as mass vote rigging.
So they're not looking to overthrow the government. They just wanted to reform it. But what is your sense? We don't have exit polls, but do you feel it was a fair election?
Well, there are many signs which make the result suspicious. Of course, we don't have any hard evidence to say whether there was vote rigging or not. But obviously, I've been following many Iranian presidential elections over the last 20 years. This one had many aspects which were really odd. And that is why a lot of people are suspicious, and they believe somebody may have had a plan beforehand to declare Ahmadinejad the president, whatever the vote.
What were some of the things that were odd that pointed to that?
Okay, the way, for instance, the results were announced. In other elections in Iran, usually they would announce results from region to region, and that would give an indication each candidate how they did in every province and all the rest of it. In this election, they were giving results after every 5 million, which you didn't know where they're coming from, which province, whether they were rural areas, big cities like Tehran. So that made a lot of people suspicious. Maybe there are plans to declare results in a very different way this time.
Yeah.
The other suspicious event in this election is the three challengers to Ahmadinejad lost even their own hometowns, which is very odd. I mean, in many countries, and especially in countries like Iran, people usually do much better in their little town or in their village because everybody knows them. But
yeah,
Here in Iran, Ahmadinejad beat all three candidates, even in their home ground.
Yeah. Well, what should we read into Ali Khamenei's order for an investigation into this election? Should we be cynical about it, or do you think that it could be a real investigation, and who will do it?
I mean, the fact of the matter is, according to Iranian election laws, after any election, there is this election body known as the Guardian Council. They must be satisfied that everything was done properly and there is no complaint and no fraud and no irregularities, and they have to declare the election valid. But in this case, Ayatollah Khamenei, just one day before the results were announced, issued a statement and in fact accepted the result, which was very unusual for Iran. And now he has seen the power of the people, that the millions of people are frustrated and all the rest of it. So he has taken a step back and now is asking the Guardian Council to investigate the result, which is a U-turn by the Supreme Leader.
A U-turn and uncharted territory, we understand. Yes, there's always been an understanding that the Guardian Council has to sign off on an election, but would this be unusual to have a real investigation?
The accusation from the reformist candidates is that if there was a massive vote rigging, the Guardian Council was involved, the Supreme Leader was involved, the Interior Ministry, which is appointed, the minister is appointed by Ahmadinejad himself, they believe they all were involved, because they say this was not a matter of a few percentage or a few thousand or a million or so. They believe there were massive vote rigging. And for a massive vote rigging, you need consensus at the top of the establishment, and everybody must have been involved.
So who will do an investigation?
I mean, legally, it is the Guardian Council. But if the Guardian Council, and the Guardian Council has 10 days to declare its opinion, and after 10 days, they come out and say, well, we have investigated and there was no fraud, I doubt the opposition would accept that. And so they, what they are asking is the annulment of the results and calling for a re-election.
So it'll be days before we know what will happen on that front. But Sadek, what about the protests today? Do you think there will be a crackdown?
So far, we haven't heard any disturbances. This is quite a peaceful demonstration. Mr. Mousavi has appeared among the people for the first time after the elections. He spoke to the people. And we also hear that there were other defeated candidates. Mr. Karoubi was there. The former president, Mr. Khatami, was also there. So a lot of reformist leaders were present, and nothing happened so far.
Well, you mentioned—
I don't think the government is going to tolerate such demonstrations for long. But what they can do about that, I think that their hands are tied, to be honest with you.
So Mr. Mousavi appeared today. He had been seen for a couple of days. There was concern. But is there concern of what happens to him now? President Ahmadinejad made a sort of a joke about how Mousavi had gone through a red light, so he was going to need to get a ticket, which some thought maybe meant something far harsher. Is there a sense of what might happen to him?
It seems to me that the Supreme Leader, who in Iran is the most powerful man in the country, much more powerful than President Ahmadinejad, it appears to me that he has taken charge of the events in the country. He met Mr. Mousavi yesterday, so it appears that Ayatollah is doing his best to calm the situation. I don't think in these circumstances Mr. Ahmadinejad can do anything to harm Mr. Mousavi, because the Supreme Leader is also involved. What the government is trying, the establishment is trying to appease the people, because they know that there are millions of people who are shocked and disappointed, and they are angry, and they're trying their best to calm the situation. But how they can do that, I think anything short of a re-election would not be acceptable to these angry people in the streets of Iran today.
Sadek Sabah, an analyst for the BBC's Persian television service, speaking to us from London, where he's been monitoring today's protest and demonstration in many cities in Iran. Sadek, thank you so much.
Not at all. Bye-bye.
Well, let's bring in Fawaz Jurjiz, as we often do when discussing events in this part of the world. He's professor of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. Professor Jurjiz, we welcome you as always, and you mince no words in your opinion of this election.
No, I don't. And my words, basically, I try to really paint a portrait of how Iranians, particularly young Iranians, female and male, view the outcome, the final outcome. I think the consensus is that the election was stolen. The word that's most used in Tehran today is that it was a coup, a bloodless coup, by the ultra-conservatives, particularly Ahmadinejad and his man and the Revolutionary Guards. and that the ultra-conservative faction within the mullahs basically have given up all democratic pretenses and joined the league or the ranks of traditional dictators in the Middle East.
Well, we just heard that the challengers even lost in their own home villages, which doesn't seem cricket. But you quote an analyst in Tehran who says it does look like a coup. It looks like they took 10 million votes from Mousavi and gave them to Ahmadinejad. Do those numbers for us.
Well, remember, I mean, the idea, Robin, before the elections, as Mousavi's campaign gained momentum in the last 2 weeks, particularly among female and young voters who represent about 70% of the population. 70% of the population are below the ages of 30 years old. And the idea was that if those 70% turn out in large numbers, basically Mousavi would gain a real advantage. If the Interior Ministry, basically, estimate is correct that 85% turn out, that means Mousavi should have done much better. He should really have gained a clear advantage over Ahmadinejad. The reality is, as your guest said a while ago, this is not just about a million votes. This is about 10 million votes. And this is really, there's a widespread belief that basically, that's why I started by saying the election was stolen. In American terms, for our American listeners, you're talking about more than 30 million votes in the American electorate. And that's why I believe that there will never be a recount.
Yeah.
I think there will never be a recount because this would expose the depth of the crisis and the fraud, the nature of the fraud. We hope that basically the Guardian Council basically would declare the outcome, basically that would cancel the outcome and will have re-election, because without a re-election, I don't think the legitimacy of the Islamic-based regime in Tehran would ever be recovered without at least annulling the elections and having a new election.
That's Fawaz Jurjis, professor of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence. We're up against a break, and we want to come back with you, Professor, but there's nothing funny about this. This is very serious, and we still don't know what might happen next if the government was going to crack down on these thousands of protesters today. But it sounds as if you're saying that behind the scenes in Tehran, someone may be saying to someone else, you took too many votes. You made it too obvious.
It really is too obvious. I mean, think about it. Basically, the way the vote was counted, the fact is that they were very close. I mean, you would imagine a scenario whereby Ahmadinejad would have, let's say, 45% and Mousavi 48% or 42%. Thirdly, I mean, to lose their hometown, I mean, such
right.
a large margin.
Makes no sense.
Many irregularities.
Professor Jurjis, we're going to take 1 minute break. We'll be right back with you. We want to remind our listeners later today, we're going to kick back with some great jazz music. But when we come back, more with Fawaz Jurjis. What happens now in Iran and the rest of the region? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Fawaz Jurjis, professor of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence, also author of The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global, and talking to us today about demonstrations all across Iran, despite a ban on demonstrations, protesters chanting the name of their candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who did put an appearance in Tehran at a rally there, urging his followers to remain calm. There had been concern as to his whereabouts. He hadn't been seen in a couple of days, but he surfaced today. Professor Jurjis, remind us, just give us a little context for this, of the reform movement, because it feels today as if we're seeing what we have seen in the past, a student uprising, a reform movement in 97, in 2003, and then disappointment. So give us a little bit of the context of the history of this current reform movement.
Well, First of all, I mean, let's remember that Mousavi is no liberal.
Well,
Mousavi is a moderate conservative.
Well, I want to just mention, I've been on Twitter, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you about that, because what's showing up on Twitter are comments allegedly from Iranians saying, don't forget, this is the former prime minister who oversaw the deaths of thousands.
Yes. I mean, initially there was a great deal of skepticism among reformists about Mousavi. Remember, Mousavi is a loyal son of the Islamic Revolution. He was and is part of the political inner circle of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this really, Robin, this really raises a critical question. If the ultra-conservative mullahs, the dominant faction within the ruling mullahs, cannot trust a loyalist like Mousavi, what does this tell you? It tells you about how out of touch they are with reality and with the hopes and aspirations and fears of young Iranians. It tells you that they are terrified of their shadows and they really lack confidence and direction about the future. It tells you about the crisis of legitimacy which the ruling mullahs basically has. You asked me about the movement, the reform movement. I think what we need to understand is that Mousavi's campaign gained momentum in the last 3 weeks. As a result, he began to construct positions on social policy, on social freedoms, on women, on the economy, on foreign policy that appealed in particular to female and young voters who represent the largest constituency in Iran. And in particular, one of the most important drivers in his campaign was, of course, Zahra. Zahra is his wife, mm-hmm. a scholar, an artist, a former chancellor of university. Zahra electrified the female vote. The female vote, Robin, here to our listeners, represents out of the 46 million voters in Iran, there are about 25 million votes, female votes. It's one of the largest voting constituency in Iran, and women since 2001 have played, actually since 1997, have played a critical part in basically empowering the campaigns of reformists like former President Mohammad Khatami and so on and so forth. So even though that Mousavi is no liberal, even though he is part of the system, you know how it is, politics basically has a logic of its own. He basically became a magnet, an outlet for the frustration and the aspiration and basically the hopes and the fears of young voters and female voters, thanks to his wife and his own evolution. And that's why basically Mousavi now, really it's not just about Mousavi, it's about the frustration of millions of young Iranians and women and men who would like basically to have, and the election here, it's not just about foreign policy, really is a minor issue in the campaign. What we're really talking about is social freedom.
Right.
Of women basically to walk on the streets, showing their hair, dressing in a particular way. Because what Ahmadinejad has done in the last 4 years is to crack down on women rights activists, to institute policies that discriminate against women, for example, via custody battles in workplaces. You have now the so-called the morality police in Iran chasing young teenagers if they show their hair or dress in a particular way. And this is why the reform movement viewed Zahra and Mousavi as a symbol, as a channel, as an outlet that they could really basically see Iran changing and evolving in the next 4 years.
It sounds like you're saying he's no Mohammad Khatami, who did win a landslide in 97, and they were inspired so many to join a reform movement. But he has become the symbol of the current reform movement. Just in the couple minutes we have, Fawaz Georges, what happens now?
Well, I think Iran has really often surprised us. I would not be surprised in the next 1 week or so if the Guardian Council led by the Supreme Leader, basically say, well, look, we don't know the situation, let's have a re-election. In particular, if they realize, remember now, Robin, the regime itself is facing a grave existential crisis. This is not about the physical survival. That's not it. The regime will survive. It's a crisis of governance, the loss of public trust and support. And in this particular sense, no regime, including the mullahs,
could govern effectively at home or pursue a foreign policy without public support and public trust. And this is why I would not be surprised if the Guardian Council in the next 10 days tell us, listen, let's have a new day, let's have a new election. I think this is the only way out of the deadly embrace in which the mullahs find themselves today.
That's Fawaz Jerjes, professor of Middle Eastern Studies and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. Just a few seconds now, but does this stun you that that's a possibility?
No, it does not at all. I think they're blundered. I think the ultra-conservative mullahs and the Revolutionary Guards have blundered monstrously, and they realize that basically what we are seeing today is the beginning of a dissent movement, of a social movement led by young voters. And when you have the largest constituency below the age of 25 years old, they present 70%, it tells you about the gravity of the crisis faced by the mullahs today.
Fawaz Jerjes, also author of The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. We'll have to, of course, see how this plays out. It feels like we've been here before, but you're saying you think this may be different. We will obviously call you down the road to see. Professor, thank you so much, as always.
Always my pleasure.
And still ahead today, some jazz music for you after the news here and now. Happy Global Wind Day to you. Events are being staged around the world touting the promise of wind power as a clean, renewable way to meet energy needs and reduce gases that contribute to global warming. But a new study shows that in some parts of the U.S., average and peak wind speeds are declining, and ironically, the reason may be global warming. One of the study's co-authors is Eugene Tackley, professor of atmospheric science at Iowa State University. He joins us from his office there. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you and your colleagues say your findings are preliminary. Further work has to be done. But your study raises potentially a new side effect of global warming that hasn't been looked into before. What did you find?
Well, we found that, to our surprise, wind speeds are declining according to measurements that have been taken over the period from 1973 to 2000.
How much are they declining? Could you stand in Minnesota and say, wow, it really doesn't feel as windy here?
Well, it's something that's been declining gradually but systematically, and many regions of the country at rates of 1% decline per year.
Well, but isn't there also a 10% decline in average wind speed in some places?
Over the period, yes. Over the 30-year period, it's been as much as 10 or even more percent.
Where are these places that have seen the wind reduction?
The largest reductions have been in the Northeast and along the Great Lakes.
And you list states like Ohio, Indiana, Kansas, Michigan, Illinois, Louisiana, northern Maine.
Right.
And you say that there are some places, I mentioned Minnesota, where there's been a jump in the number of days where there's no wind at all?
There have been cases where the wind speeds have gone near calm for long periods of time, and we just don't quite understand that.
Well, can you try to make a stab at it, though? What is the science behind a connection between global warming and wind?
We know that the polar regions are warming more than the equatorial regions. So the difference in temperature between the equator and the North Pole is becoming less. And if the temperature difference becomes less, then the barometric pressure becomes less, and it's barometric pressure difference that drives wind, that creates wind.
Hmm.
So if we have a reduction in the pressure difference, then we're going to get a reduction in wind speed.
Well, you know, there's been some response to this idea that there's been a reduction in wind levels. An industry analyst for the American Wind Energy Association, a vested interest, obviously, but he says it doesn't matter. There's so much wind in the U.S., that we're called the Saudi Arabia of wind. So do you agree that this isn't that big a problem?
Is it a problem? We don't know. You see, the winds that we have studied are from 30 feet above the ground. We haven't studied the winds at 250 to 400 feet above the ground where wind turbines are active. So I would caution against overinterpretation of our results in terms of what it means for wind power production.
But what else could it mean? In other words, why else do we care about it?
There are lots of reasons. Certainly, it has impact on human health and agriculture are two major reasons. On the human health side, heat waves are caused by a buildup of heat and low wind speed. So if wind speeds are even lower, then our major cities that are experiencing high temperatures are going to experience even less ventilation, and so it could exacerbate a heat wave. Similarly, air pollution problems. Air pollutants build up in major cities because of stagnation events, which means that there is very low wind speed. So if we have more occurrences of these stagnation events, that's bad for human health. On the agriculture side, if we have low wind speeds at night, we're likely to get more dew forming on crops. And the more dew, the more likelihood we get fungus and diseases and pathogens forming, and so it could have a negative effect on agriculture. Similarly, during the daytime, crops depend on wind for ventilation, for cooling, when the temperature gets too high. So it could have a negative effect on agriculture production.
Eugene Tackley, a professor of atmospheric science at Iowa State University, co-author of an ongoing study showing declining wind speeds in some parts of the U.S. It's going to be published in the Journal of Geophysical Research in August. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin, for your interest.
Okay, while we're on the topic, let's stay there. We'll have some solutions to environmental challenges in India in 30 seconds, here and now. If you saw the filthy slums of Mumbai in the film Slumdog Millionaire, your takeaway might be that India is not particularly concerned with the environment. But in fact, the country is facing the urgent problem of how to keep its economy booming while preserving its environment. India is currently the world's fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases, and as our next guest, George Black, discovered, with a growing population of nearly 1.2 billion, India has some unique challenges and solutions, including an explosion of green entrepreneurship at the village level. George Black's report is in the current issue of On Earth magazine. It's published by the Natural Resources Defense Council. George, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Nice to be with you again. Thanks.
Well, and let's tick through some of the things you found that India is dealing with environmentally. And let's start with water. And you write that in some parts of India, people were coming to blows over a lack of water, which seems so odd because we also think of it as a country of monsoons. What's the disconnect?
Well, it's a country of extremes, and those extremes have always been there. The area I was writing about was Rajasthan, which is the huge desert area that borders on Pakistan in the west. And you've got parts of that desert that can get as little as 4 inches of rain a year. And then you're getting more and more intense monsoon patterns driven by climate change. So, for example, in Mumbai, the commercial capital of the country, they had 35 to 40 inches of rain in one 36-hour period, if you can imagine that. Mm-hmm. And the glaciers in the Himalayas are melting faster than anyone can keep track of. I spoke with India's leading glaciologist. He says the Himalayan glaciers are going to be gone completely in 30 years.
30 years?
The consequences of that are almost impossible to fathom because 1.5 billion people depend on those for water, for crops, for livelihood. So the water crisis has a lot of different aspects to it.
Let's just take one of them, the heavy rainfall. One of the problems is it happens so quickly, it's not being contained. So what are some ways that Indians are holding on to that rainwater?
They're using a lot of traditional techniques. There are a lot of people out in the field who are, I guess, mistrustful of the speed with which government operates, the efficiency with which government operates, and they're trying really to revive techniques that go back as long as people have lived in the desert and faced water problems. I mean, it can be as simple as digging a hole in the sand and waiting for water to seep in, or it can be various kinds of wells and ponds that are, you know, collecting rainfall channeled from nearby hills, or it can increasingly be very sophisticated stuff. We saw a solar-powered distillation plant. It's the weirdest thing you ever saw. It looks like the spaceship in The Day the Earth Stood Still that plunks down on the White House lawn. It traps the groundwater and the rainwater. The groundwater is very salty. It feeds them through an elaborate process of tubes. Basically, the water inside the pyramid is distilled and separates the salt out and then gives the villagers salt, which they can sell in the market and increase their incomes, and also fresh water to drink. So there's a lot of innovation and there's a lot of tradition mixed.
And one of the innovations has to do with educating communities as to how they can capture their own rainwater and then guard it. In one case, reading about a pond where they post a guard so that no one will defecate in the pond, but making it feel like a community project.
Yeah, and at the same time, again, that's tradition and innovation combined, because there has always been a strength in local communities. I mean, this was Gandhi's whole philosophy, that the sense of community at the village level was what made India, India. But there's also this spirit that we hear a lot about of entrepreneurialism.
Let's talk about electricity. 400 million people in rural India still without access to electricity. You're right, 60% of fresh produce is lost before it even gets to market, no refrigeration. So what are some of the answers there?
Again, it comes down to critiquing what government has and hasn't been able to do and coming up with remedies locally to fill the gap. So often you'll see villages that have a few poles with electricity lines, but the power doesn't run through them, or it only runs in the middle of the night when people can't use it. So some of the non-governmental groups, especially those with a technical bent, are doing very impressive work installing local renewable energy projects that are off the national grid. And in this country, you tend to think, you know, if you live off the grid, you're a hippie. If you're in India, it can actually paradoxically be a way for you to get into the economic mainstream. You have a little small-scale solar plant or a plant that's burning wood or cow dung even, and you can actually generate enough electricity locally that you can stick in refrigeration facilities to your village. Then the fresh produce that you're losing is saved, your profits increase, your connection to the markets increases. And you sort of join the mainstream, as it were, by remaining off the grid.
Well, in the type of electricity that's being used, you write, until this year, there was no option but kerosene lamps in some parts of the country. 68 million Indian homes use these lamps, and it's hard to think of 68 million of these, you know, smoky wicks that burn black, and we know what a kerosene lamp can do if a child knocks it over. Just terrible problems. The dirtiest of all fossil fuels, you write. And there's an alternative program now called Lighting a Billion Lives. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, this problem of kerosene, this isn't just India. And so when they say lighting a billion lives, I think what they have in mind is not just the 400 million or so in India who have no electricity. It's, again, this very user-friendly local technology that I think they see spreading into Africa and into other parts of Asia. There is a device called a solar lantern. You charge it from a small charging station that's powered by solar panels. It keeps the charge for most of the day. And the government takes the approach of subsidizing the supply of these lanterns. So it will say, okay, you can have it for 50% off. Well, the problem is 50% off is $40. Mm-hmm. And people in India, in the villages, that's more than a month's wages. The organization that does this, which is called TERI, the Energy and Resources Institute in New Delhi, Terry said, instead of selling them at a subsidized price, you rent them. And you figure people are paying 2 rupees, let's say 4 cents a day, for kerosene for their lanterns. If you can rent them the solar lanterns for the same price, they can have reliable, bright light, absolutely safe, absolutely renewable. The kids do their homework by lamplight. The local village economy runs better. The women meet at night and discuss the issues that concern them. And again, the wheels of the community turn much more efficiently, much more productively. And it's very simple.
Well, but that gets to a question that keeps arising as I keep reading. Cars, for instance. As Indians advance and want more and more cars, isn't this one of the problems that might surface, that more and more pollution?
Oh, totally, totally. I see absolutely what you mean. And it's a built-in dilemma. You raise people out of poverty, they consume more energy. I met with the head of the Society of Indian Automobile Manufacturers, the national conglomerate, which in a sense is quite likely to become the biggest car-making power in the world. And this guy is sitting there saying things you would never hear from a senior person in Detroit, which is the challenge here is not to sell people cars. The challenge is to get people mobile in a way that is environmentally sustainable. That was his entire approach. And that raises actually some very paradoxical things that surprised me a lot. One thing we've heard a fair amount about is the idea of this new extremely low-cost car, the Nano, the cheapest car in the world. And you're an environmentalist and you listen to the promotion on this, it'll cost about $2,000, $2,500. It'll get 50 miles to the gallon plus. So your immediate instinct is, that's wonderful. But then you imagine putting tens of millions of these on the road, and suddenly it doesn't look so wonderful. But you think about SUVs, which to us in the West, an environmentalist regards as anathema. And in India, if you look at what an SUV is doing, first of all, they have very high mileage requirements. And secondly, they're used as buses to take kids to school. They're used to take produce to market. So they're actually workhorses that can be very environmentally efficient. So I think when you go into a country like India, you have to kind of leave some of your preconceptions at the airport.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Sunday morning, it's every day.
Name that tune.
For all I care, I'm not scared. Light my candles in a daze, 'cause I found God.
You're right if you said it's Lithium by the late Kurt Cobain of Nirvana. But it's being performed by the jazz trio The Bad Plus. And Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs says it's just one of several unexpected departures from the great American songbook that jazz musicians are taking. James joins us with more. James, hello.
Hi, Robin.
And tell us more about The Bad Plus.
They're a piano-based drums trio from Minneapolis, as they say out there. Mm-hmm. And during the past 5 years or so, they've really shaken things up in the world of improvised music. The piano solo we just heard by Ethan Iverson and the disembodied voice by Wendy Lewis, well, she joined the Bad Plus on their latest disc from which we heard Lithium. The album's called For All I Care, and it's on the Heads Up label.
No, it's great, but it's not completely new that jazz musicians depart from the American songbook.
No, it isn't, but this trend is most assuredly on the uptick, I would say, in the past 5 years. Robin, if you go back to the 1960s, you'll find the Keith Jarrett Trio and the Gary Burton Quartet doing Dylan tunes really well. And during that action-packed decade, such elders as Duke Ellington and Count Basie made albums of Beatles songs.
Well, and more recently, the late trumpeter Lester Bowie and his band Brass Fantasy recorded Madonna, Michael Jackson, Spice Girls, Marilyn Manson. What's the result when this happens?
Well, when Lester Bowie, the Bad Plus, and other contemporary improvisers like the pianist Brad Meldow and the trumpeter Dave Douglas, from whom we'll hear presently, when they delve into the music of Nick Drake or Radiohead or Rufus Wainwright, they are both placing their highly personal stamps on these selections and perhaps introducing some of their listeners to an alternative musical world. They're expanding the repertoire. I mean, how many times can one hear All the Things You Are or Satin Doll, right?
Well, let's go back to the Bad Plus, their CD For All I Care. What else do they cover?
They explore compositions by such modern classical composers as Stravinsky, the father of modern classical music, and Milton Babbitt. And they also put their own spin not only on Nirvana, but on the music of Pink Floyd and the alternative rock-slash-country band Wilco.
Now, Jeff Tweedy, the creative force behind Wilco, has been on the program.
Uh-huh.
You have a compare and contrast for us.
I do indeed. First, we'll hear Wilco take it to the bridge of Radio Cure, and that's off their brilliant album Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. The song was co-written by singer Jeff Tweedy and multi-instrumentalist Jay Bennett, who died recently, I'm saddened to say.
Picking apples for the kings and queens and things I've never seen. Oh, distance has no way making love understandable.
So that's Wilco.
That's right. Now here's the Bad Plus and their take on the bridge of Wilco's Radio Cure. Notice how after the snippet of Ethan Iverson's piano, they modulate from major to minor when the singer returns. The Bad Plus, right now, with Wendy Lewis, the voice.
Picking apples for the kings and queens of things I've never seen. Oh, distance has no way of making.
It's hard to remember we're doing a jazz segment.
It's true. You're right.
That's quite something.
Uh-huh.
Okay, what's next?
Well, just a few minutes ago, we mentioned trumpeter-composer Dave Douglas. Well, Douglas has a stunning new collection called Spirit Moves. It's on the Greenleaf Music label. Dave Douglas is 46 years old, and he is a risk-taker, big time. There's virtually nothing he won't try, musically speaking. He's played hard bop, fusion, European folk forms, avant-garde classical music. I'm sure I've forgotten about eight other categories. Okay, what I want to highlight is Dave Douglas's treatment of singer-songwriter Rufus Wainwright's This Love Affair. Transported to a New Orleans funeral parade as the mourners proceed to the cemetery, with Douglas recalling the emotional power of the greatest trumpeter of them all, Louis Armstrong.
Rufus Wainwright's This Love Affair, as channeled by trumpeter Dave Douglas, with the group Brass Ecstasy. The CD is Spirit Moves. James, any more covers on it?
Yeah, the group gives us Otis Redding's soul rocker Mr. Pitiful and the Hank Williams classic heart-tugging country ballad I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. Both are superb, as is this entire set, which is otherwise comprised of Dave Douglas originals. It's first rate across the board. Dave Douglas's Spirit Moves.
Finally, James, you spoke earlier about jazz players occasionally using Bob Dylan tunes as springboards for improvisation. Now you've got one of Bob Dylan's early signature songs for us.
I do, Robin, and I think most people know the song Masters of War, one of the key finger-pointing songs from the early 1960s by the angry young Dylan. When Dylan originally sang or snarled this song, he expressed the hope that he'd see the various masters of war dead and buried in their graves. But I bet you've never heard this eloquent, pensive rendition with Bach-like undertones by the guitar duo of Jim Hall and Bill Frisell. It's on the 2-CD set Hemispheres on the Artist's Share label. Listen to how gently and elegiacally Jim Hall and Bill Frisell treat this song. Jim Hall, who is 78, and Bill Frisell, age 58, share a deep musical bond that's gone from master acolyte to teacher student to inspired colleagues, and their guitars interweave beautifully throughout this two-disc set. One disc is the guitar duo, and the other is a quartet, with the highly intuitive bass drum tandem of Scott Colley, the bassist, Joey Barron, the drummer.
Well, we want to listen to more as we go. That's Dylan's Masters of War, interpreted by Jim Hall, Bill Frisell. As we speak about departures from the standard songbook with Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs, who always sets a new standard every time he visits. James, thanks so much.
Robin, you're too kind. I'll see you soon with more of the music that helps me get out of bed every evening.
That's right. You get out of bed in the evening. James, thanks.
Sure.